Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Chris Tenzing, editor of Middle East Report, who examines growing armed resistance to the U.S. military occupation of Iraq. Ted Glick of the Independent Progressive Politics Network, who summarizes the plans coming out of the first organizing conference of United for Peace and Justice, a national progressive coalition that developed around opposition to the U.S. war in Iraq. And Stanton Glantz, professor of medicine at the University of California, who discusses recent developments related to ongoing campaigns to curb smoking and the power of big tobacco. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After 7 years of hearing testimony about apartheid's atrocities, South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission has completed its mission. This spring, it recommended that the ANC-led government pay $375 million in reparations to the victims of the racist state and to fund it with a special wealth tax from corporations that financially benefited from the apartheid system. In mid-April, South African President Thabo Mbeki rejected these bold recommendations. According to the World Press Review magazine, Mbeki only agreed to pay a single $74 million settlement to over 19,000 victims of torture and abuse, but refused to create a special tax to pay for it. A case filed in Brooklyn, New York, is seeking damages against 21 companies that benefited from apartheid, including IBM, J.P. Morgan Chase, Ford, and General Motors. South African Justice Minister Penwell Maduna says the class action suits, if they succeed, would damage investment prospects in the African nation and create more unemployment among the black majority. The government's pro-business stand alarmed some media commentators. The Sunday Times suggested there is a reluctance on the part of the ANC government to force white business to cough up for its past sins. Economist Sampi Terreblanche remarked, "Unfortunately, the poor were let down again, and the ANC lost an opportunity to wage a war on poverty with the revenues from a new wealth tax to benefit the impoverished majority, who he calls the real victims of colonialism, apartheid, and the struggle." The BBC reports that a Belgian court will proceed with a lawsuit brought by Palestinian survivors of the 1982 massacre in two Lebanese refugee camps against Israeli General Amos Yaron. Yaron at the time was in charge of the Beirut district after Israel invaded the country. The suit charges that Yaron, now Director General of the Israeli Defense Ministry, had committed crimes against humanity by allowing Christian militiamen to enter the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps. The militia engaged in a revenge attack that resulted in the murder of several hundred civilians while Israeli troops encircled the area near the camps. Belgium's universal competence law, under which the suit was brought, allows the nation's courts to prosecute human rights cases not directly tied to Belgium. The law was amended recently to allow transfer of such cases to a defendant's country of origin if their court systems were deemed fair. However, in this case, Belgium rejected a transfer to Israeli courts. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld has threatened that unless Belgium changes its universal competence law, the U.S. may stop attending NATO meetings in Brussels, the home of NATO's headquarters. He also said that the U.S. will withhold funding for new NATO buildings to protest the law under which suits have been brought against U.S. officials for alleged war crimes committed during America's two wars with Iraq. 30 years ago, on September 11, 1973, Chile's socialist president Salvador Allende was overthrown in a bloody military coup that led to the death of thousands of political activists, students, and union workers. To the horror of many American union members, it has recently been revealed that between 1971 and 1973, the AFL-CIO's government-funded American Institute for Free Labor Development, or AFELD, was actively trying to destabilize the Allende regime in cooperation with the Nixon administration and the CIA. Funds went to right-wing professional unions and anti-government political groups that helped create the social unrest which was the pretext for the military coup by General Augusto Pinochet. Yet after the Pinochet coup, AFELD could not save its allies. Pinochet saw every union member as an enemy and rounded up hundreds of union workers who were tortured, murdered, or disappeared. Although AFL-CIO President John Sweeney cleaned out many of the old Cold Warriors in 1995, many still question the Federation's long-term relationship with the Confederation of Venezuelan Workers. The union, along with the Chamber of Commerce, organized a costly and bitter strike to oust President Hugo Chavez. Sweeney actively opposed any coup attempt against Chavez, but critics note the AFL's program aiding unions in Venezuela was bankrolled by the National Endowment for Democracy, funded by Congress. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau. With growing attention being focused on the Bush administration's failure to locate Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, the president's principal justification for war, Congress and the media are beginning to ask some tough questions about the possible exaggeration or manipulation of information gathered by intelligence agencies. Against this backdrop, armed resistance to the U.S. military occupation of Iraq is becoming more deadly with each passing day. Over the past 2 weeks, attacks by guerrilla forces centered in cities north of Baghdad have killed at least 10 American soldiers, wounded 25, and shot down an Apache helicopter. Ambushes by these forces against U.S. troops, described by Washington as remnants of the Ba'athist Party loyal to Saddam Hussein or terrorists sympathetic to al-Qaeda, are almost a daily occurrence. The U.S. has responded by sending thousands of troops into conflicted areas and aggressive house-to-house searches for weapons, tactics which have angered many anti-Saddam civilians who increasingly resent the occupation of their nation. The killing of 18 unarmed protesters by U.S. soldiers in the city of Fallujah last month has also fanned the flames of hostility and sparked a cry for revenge. In all, 40 U.S. soldiers have been killed in Iraq, many from hostile fire, since the Pentagon announced on May 1st the end of war operations. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Chris Tenzing, editor of Middle East Report, who examines the growing armed resistance in Iraq and the possibility that the increasing number of guerrilla attacks could signal the beginning of a protracted conflict.
Who is the resistance? I don't have an authoritative answer on that. I do have some reason to believe from, you know, eyewitness reports from reliable Iraqi sources that there are some members of the old Republican Guard and even the old security services who have been agitating and have been participating in some of these demonstrations of crowds, such as the one in Fallujah that led to the shooting of unarmed protesters. But I think it's very unlikely that every Iraqi who's involved in either those unarmed demonstrations or the armed attacks on U.S. soldiers is an ex-Ba'athist or an ex-supporter of Saddam Hussein's regime. It's more likely that what do we see in this area, predominantly Sunni areas northwest of Baghdad, is the U.S. operating in an area which was the social base of support for Saddam Hussein's regime, not necessarily because they bought his ideology and were apologists for him, but because they were recipients of disproportionately good treatment, both in terms of the services provided by the state and in terms of job opportunities and all of those things for social promotion of the people in that area, and that they fear loss in status in post-war Iraq to the other elements in Iraq, particularly the Shia population, that appears to have, you know, keeping lines open to the occupation authorities. I think some of the resistance also simply comes from a sense of Iraqi nationalism. While they may have been happy to see Saddam Hussein's regime fall and are happy that he's no longer governing them, even if he is still alive in Iraq, they're not happy at all about an indefinite foreign occupation of their country, especially not if the occupying force is going to employ rather heavy-handed tactics to put down any and all expressions of dissent and resistance. You know, certainly, I think the more heavy-handed the tactics become, house-to-house searches of houses with absolutely no reason to believe that there's anyone inside who poses a threat to the U.S. forces, these types of measures are likely to engender the kind of resentment toward U.S. forces that eventually we may be able to compare to Palestinian resentment toward Israeli occupying forces, the kind of pan-Iraqi resentment of the occupation that could, in the future, boil over into a genuine social intifada against a U.S. occupation. I think it's way too early to say that that's happening. It would take a long time for such a thing to develop, but it's possible that that could happen, particularly if the United States does not make some positive progress on these questions of indigenous governance, and particularly the questions of providing basic security and basic amenities to the population. All of these omens are not good, and I would say the chances are pretty high that it will turn into what can be called a quagmire.
The Bush administration seems to have gone out of its way in recent weeks to label those elements of armed resistance in Iraq attacking U.S. troops as terrorists or specifically as sympathetic to al-Qaeda, and despite the fact that there's no evidence or direct connection between Saddam Hussein's old government and Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, the group that carried out the attack against the United States on September 11th. Is it possible that the Bush administration is setting up a justification to increase the level of troops in Iraq to combat an insurgency that may develop later and be able to sell that to the American public by labeling any future fight around the U.S. occupation of Iraq as a fight against terrorism?
That's certainly possible, and I agree with the premise of your question, and we saw this during the war as well, that virtually any acts of resistance against the invading forces are to be labeled death squads, terrorism, these very inflammatory labels, which probably distort the reality on the ground. Paul Bremer is now freely using the word occupation to describe the U.S. presence in Iraq when we heard constantly before the war that we are not coming as your occupiers, we're coming as your liberators. All of this rhetoric has suddenly been thrown down the memory hole, but not down the memory hole of Iraqis. I think that one reason why the administration has put so much focus on, quote, foreign fighters who may have links to Osama bin Laden or God knows who else is that leaves open, talking about Sunni militants leaves open the prospect of blaming things on Syria. Talking about the influence of Iran on the Shia religious parties leaves open the possibility of blaming unrest in Iraq among the Iraqi population upon Iranian meddling. And it provides a pretext, which probably would be one of many, for more vigorous intervention in Iran than is currently taking place. So, in that regard, the unrest in Iraq could, paradoxically enough, even though it should be taken as evidence of the failure of the strategic vision of the neoconservatives who are probably still driving Middle East policy in the Bush administration, it will be taken as evidence that we simply haven't finished yet and that we need to implement the entirety of the neocons' vision rather than simply the first step. That is one ominous possibility that is out there.
That was Chris Tenzing, editor of Middle East Report. Contact Middle East Report by calling area code 202-223-3677 or visit their website at www.merip.org. In the months before the Bush administration invaded Iraq, millions of people across the globe demonstrated their opposition to what they believed was an unprovoked and illegal war, driven by America's quest for oil and world domination. Many of the large anti-war protests in the United States were organized by United for Peace and Justice, or UFPJ, a new progressive coalition which came together in October 2002. United for Peace helped to organize the historic February 15th, the World Says No to War protests held in New York, San Francisco, and dozens of cities across the U.S., joining over 600 cities worldwide. But since the end of the first phase of the U.S.-led Iraq war, street demonstrations have all but disappeared, prompting many to ask, whatever happened to the peace movement? An answer could be found in Chicago, June 6th through the 8th, where over 550 activists attended the UFPJ's first national conference to determine organizational structure, strategy, and priorities. During the three-day gathering, delegates representing 325 local and national groups from 38 states vowed to fight empire building, permanent war, and attacks on civil liberties and immigrants. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ted Glick, national coordinator of the Independent Progressive Politics Network, who attended the conference. He summarizes the plans that emerged from the meeting, which he believes have the potential to change the American political landscape.
UFPJ brings together a very broad cross-section of groups. That's one of the exciting things about it. Student organizations, youth groups, people of color organizations, of course the peace groups, the religious community, labor, just across the board. It's a whole potentially very powerful alliance that could over time turn this country around. It's a very significant development. There are tens of millions of people, huge numbers of people in this country who reject the direction this country is going in, not just a million or a million and a half or 2 million, who demonstrated leading up to the war. It's the many, many more who polls showed, and the work that we did out there interacting with people showed, are very, very concerned about the direction of the country. We came out of the weekend with a plan in terms of decisions about major priorities as far as campaigns that are beginning to unfold and that we'll be developing. We came out of it with a structure, an agreement on a basic structure, kind of fairly minimal, but enough to have both democracy and a mechanism for accountability. We elected a leadership. We agreed on a basic strategic framework to move kind of how we would make decisions in the future as far as work, what would be our primary areas of concentration. People are prepared to keep working, to intensify, to deepen the work, to broaden it out in terms of the issues, to have the agenda be the occupation of Iraq, but also other occupations, such as the occupation that's taking place of the West Bank and Gaza. People saw the importance of linking the anti-war movement, the anti-empire movement, with the global justice movement, the movement against corporate globalization. That was a high priority in terms of what we saw taking place. We will be actively working to build support for actions taking place in Cancun, New Mexico, September 10th through the 15th, when the World Trade Organization is having a major meeting, a ministerial meeting. There'll also be demonstrations around the country on that date. And then in November 19th through the 21st, there's another ministerial meeting for this free trade area of the Americas that Bush and corporate bigwigs are pushing to create a so-called free trade zone throughout the entire Americas. And there's going to be a huge mobilization, it looks like, to Miami, and we will be part of that. There's also activities that member groups of United for Peace and Justice are initiating, or groups that we see ourselves building ties with. The Kensington Welfare Rights Union is planning a march in the month of August, starting in Mississippi, August 2nd, and coming all the way up to Washington, D.C., arriving by August 30th, around the issues of economic human rights, economic justice, poverty. That's something we're supporting. So, those are some of the things, some of the directions that we adopted.
How do you feel United for Peace and Justice will deal with the upcoming electoral period leading up to the November 2004 election, where there's a lot at stake in terms of the future of U.S. foreign and domestic policy?
Well, United for Peace and Justice, of course, will not be supporting any candidates. That's not its nature, and there are member groups of UFPJ that are officially nonprofit groups, and they could not be members if UFPJ was explicitly supporting candidates. So that will not be happening. But my interpretation of where UFPJ as a whole is at is that we think that first we can make a very big contribution to mobilizing a very strong progressive vote if we keep the peace movement going, if we stay out in the streets, if we show visibility at Cancun and at Miami in November and at a People's Convention and up at the Democratic Convention, then with a huge turnout in New York City at the Republican Convention on the first day when Bush is there in New York City, that we think that can definitely be a very significant factor in terms of the mobilization of people to come out and vote, getting more people to register, more people to come out and vote, underlining the urgency of this time, which we all feel. But I would also say that UFPJ I think will continue to be a place where people who have different approaches towards how we deal with this basically undemocratic, winner-take-all, corporate-dominated electoral system that we have. Bottom line, again, the best contribution that UFPJ can make, and I think in general that we can make as a movement is to keep some movement going and to be visible and to show that people are not accepting the Bush agenda and to keep building that and having that grow over this next 16, 17 months. That will stimulate and motivate progressive voters, including progressive non-voters, to come out and vote.
That was Ted Glick, National Coordinator of the Independent Progressive Politics Network. To contact United for Peace and Justice, call area code 212-603-3700 or visit their website at www.unitedforpeace.org. Tobacco use causes 400,000 deaths per year in the United States. Worldwide, deaths attributable to smoking now stand at 5 million a year. While tobacco companies are aggressively pursuing markets overseas, opponents are stepping up their fight against smoking with several high-profile campaigns. Although last month a Florida appeals court reversed a multi-billion dollar settlement against Big Tobacco on behalf of that state's smokers, the plaintiffs are expected to appeal the decision. Meanwhile, other class action suits are going forward, including one charging tobacco companies with false advertising for their claim that low-tar cigarettes are not as harmful as regular cigarettes. In the international battle against tobacco use, the Bush administration recently reversed its previous opposition to passage of a landmark global anti-smoking treaty sponsored by the World Health Organization. However, the U.S. has not yet signed the accord, which has so far been endorsed by 28 nations. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Stanton Glantz, professor of medicine at the University of California at San Francisco. Glantz, an authority on the health impacts of tobacco, discusses ongoing campaigns to curb smoking, including his own project, which attacks the glamorization of tobacco in Hollywood movies.
There's a tremendous amount in the news about tobacco, some of it very good, some of it very bad. The good things that are happening is a resurgence of the clean indoor air movement and the move towards smoke-free environments. These laws, which are passing both at the local and state levels around the country, protect people from the thousands of toxic chemicals and secondhand smoke and create an environment that makes it easier for people to stop smoking. There have also been some major victories in the courts on behalf of six smokers and also against the tobacco industry for the fraud of light cigarettes and marketing cigarettes as light and mild when consumers think these cigarettes are delivering less poisonous substances when in fact they're basically indistinguishable from so-called regular cigarettes. The Bush administration also caved into world pressure and agreed not to oppose the WHO's Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. Now, while that's a long way from George Bush signing the treaty and submitting it to Congress for ratification, at least the United States didn't continue to lobby to kill the treaty or water it down. And by the end, it was standing virtually alone on behalf of the cigarette companies in the world community in doing that. Probably the worst thing that's happened is a couple of weeks ago, the Florida Court of Appeals reversed itself and decertified a large class action suit on behalf of addicted smokers in Florida. It was really a stunning reversal because the same court 4 years earlier had reviewed the question of whether it was appropriate to bring a class action suit in this case and said yes. And when the tobacco industry appealed again, the court reversed itself. It was actually mind-boggling.
In that situation, whoever's on the losing end of a lawsuit, can the loser just continue to appeal and hope that eventually the court would reverse itself? Can it go on like that indefinitely?
Well, for most normal people, no. But if you're a cigarette company with an infinite amount of money, yes, you can just keep, you know, reappealing. And, you know, my expectation is that the lawyers for the plaintiffs in that case will appeal the decision, although it's going to be very difficult. they can go back and ask the Court of Appeals to have the full court hear the case, not just a three-judge panel, and they can go to the Florida Supreme Court, which now includes several appointees from Jeb Bush, and Jeb Bush, like his brother George, are very pro-tobacco. The tobacco industry is one of the major sources of campaign contributions for both Bush directly and also the Republican Party, both at the national level and in many, many of the states. And the Bush administration is just filled with people who are allied with the tobacco industry. Karl Rove, who is Bush's primary political advisor, used to do political work for Philip Morris. So the situation looks pretty bad in terms of that individual case. Now, there are many other cases that are going quite well.
You have your own project, which I'd like to talk about. It's about youth and the movies, and just tell us briefly what that involves.
Well, the American movies are probably the most powerful pro-tobacco influence in the world today. And I have a campaign running called Smoke-Free Movies, which is designed to try to break up Hollywood and big tobacco. The connections between Hollywood and the tobacco industry go back decades. The industry has a long history of paying people off in Hollywood and giving them both financially and through other ways, like getting them publicity or free cigarettes or things like that. What we're saying now is that that's got to stop, that the movies are a major pro-tobacco influence on kids. There's a tremendously strong scientific case that smoking in the movies encourages kids to smoke. It's a linear, what's called a dose-response relationship. The more the kids see, the more likely they are to smoke. And we're saying that's got to end. I'm trying to get any movie with smoking in it rated R. That would get rid of almost all the smoking that kids see, because most of the smoking is in PG-13 movies. And if the studios were confronted with an R rating versus promoting a pack of Marlboros, they'll just take the Marlboros out. Also, to have a certification that nobody got paid off in any movie that includes smoking, an anti-smoking ad prior to any film with smoking in it, and no brand identification. And the important thing about all of these policies is none of them involve censorship. None of them involve any regulation of the content of the film at all. It's just proper labeling and the film industry taking responsibility for its actions.
That was tobacco researcher Stanton Glantz. For more information, call his office at the University of California at area code 415-476-4683 or visit their research center's website at www.smokefreemovies.ucsf.edu. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Sasha Summer Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.